Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth.
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Today, I'd like to thank Marianne Crawford, Rita Sheldrake, Marilyn Ryan, and Deborah Gordon, four stalwart supporters of the Peter B. Collins Show. If you'd like to help and you're financially able, go to peterbcollins.com, where our monthly subscriptions, voluntary ones, start as low as $5 a month. It's on the right-hand side of the homepage. In the second portion of this podcast, we catch up with correspondence and clippings that have been piling up on the messy desk of your humble host. And Gary Chu, our official film reviewer, has a review of the new feature film, The Pat Tillman Story. But first, I'm pleased to reintroduce Professor Lisa Hajar. She is a professor of sociology at the University of California in Santa Barbara, and she's on leave this semester, and she is checking in today from the naval base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, the site of America's maximum security war on terror prison, and it's also the site of these kangaroo court military tribunal operations. And Professor Hajar has taken a great deal of her time to follow the case of the Canadian who was arrested as a teenager in Afghanistan. His name is Omar Khadr, and he took a plea deal this week. We're going to get details now from Professor Hajar. Lisa, thanks for what you're doing, and thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. Well, one clarification, I'm not actually on leave. I'm playing hooky to be down here covering the trial.
Well, as long as you're willing to admit that, I was giving you cover.
I'm covered with guest lecturers for a week and a half.
Okay. So. Well, thank you for then taking the effort to do that so that you could be there. Yes. And you reported to us earlier in the summer when there was a start to the Khadr trial, and then it was suspended because his military lawyer was ill. And now, as you returned to Guantanamo to cover what you thought was going to be a trial, at the very last minute, they announced a plea bargain deal of this week. Tell us a little bit about the jockeying up to that point, and I'll ask you first to tell us about the government's position. Why would they offer a plea deal to this young man after he's been incarcerated for 9 years, and they've built up a strong media case against him, essentially accusing him of war crimes for committing combat acts in a war zone, which I find to be a novel interpretation of the law?
The case of Omar Khadr has been really going on for many, many years, and it, as you mentioned, it sort of entered into its last phase this past summer when they finished the pretrial hearings and actually started the trial. I think when Khadr's military lawyer, John Jackson, collapsed on that first day, I mean, they were ready to go to trial. We were actually in the trial. A few days before that, the judge had made the ruling that all of Khadr's self-incriminating statements were in. You know, I mean, he was not going to exclude any of the self-incriminating statements, and that was largely the main evidence against Khadr, you know, was his own statements he'd made between 2002 and 2005, both at Bagram and Guantanamo. So that was a big a defeat, in a sense, for the defense. I mean, they would have had to, you know, sort of re-challenge all of that in front of the military jury. So the government at the time had really, you know, was quite happy that those statements had gone in and felt that, you know, they sort of demonstrated the strength of their case. But, and while there's been, as you mentioned, you know, a strong, the government has built up a strong media support, on the other hand, there's like probably an equally strong media opposition or opposition to this case playing out in the media for a number of reasons, but not least of which is the fact that Omar was 15 years old at the time he was arrested and captured, and more, you know, perhaps equally importantly, the fact that he is the only person at Guantanamo who's been charged with a hot war violation. So the reinterpretation of the laws of war to make it into a war crime to kill a soldier in a firefight, I mean, that's not ever been regarded as a war crime. So there's been a lot of criticism, you know, within the military, within legal circles, and certainly human rights circles about the legitimacy or sort of just rationality of going forward with this case. So I think both sides had an interest in having this case plead out, because even if the defense had successfully challenged or persuaded the military jury Omar guilty on the killing charge, the charge that he threw the grenade that killed Sergeant Spear, any of the other charges would have carried 25 years to life. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in some ways, it would have been highly risky for the defense to, you know, go into a trial. And for the prosecution, prosecutors generally like plea bargains because it, you know, as it saves the court's time, but it also had the added benefit of getting the story off the headlines more quickly and, you know, allowing the Obama administration, at least from the State Department side or the international perspective side, to, you know, save face. And when the plea bargain was it, pardon me?
Well, I was just going to interject because this whole issue of the hot fire zone, and here is a teenager who is accused of throwing this. That's trying to create a whole new area of law, and it seems that when you look at the record to date of the expansion of executive authority, the repudiation of the Geneva Conventions related to so-called enemy combatants, our government should be hopefully reticent to try to create new law out of a specific case like this. And further, wouldn't a full trial have led to challenging of his incriminating statements that they were made under duress without a lawyer by a minor, at least in the case of the early Bagram interrogations, and quite likely involving torture?
Yes, I mean, that was in fact what the trial was leading up to. I mean, even the very first day before Jackson collapsed, I mean, it was clear that they were aiming to challenge the credibility of statements made under those circumstances. However, now that Cotter, and I'll say something else about the law in a moment, but now that Cotter has pled guilty, the defense is still going to be bringing witnesses now, not so much to talk about the facts of the statements, but the conditions under which Omar made those statements that, you know, go to the plea bargain. And to some extent, the military jury gets to weigh his age, the conditions of his detention, and so on, when thinking about what kind of a sentence to give him. So I think that, you know, it's really was a crapshoot, and the defense, you know, on the one hand, you could take the principled position that this is the opportunity to challenge the way in which the U.S. government has altered the, you know, the interpretation of the laws of war, but you're taking that risk with someone's life. And in a sense, I think that they felt that, you know, what is reputed to be an 8-year sentence, that's what the plea bargain is reputed to be. Mm-hmm. So that, I think that they figured that, you know, their primary duty is to Omar. The coming back though to the question of the Geneva Conventions, it's for Omar almost alone that the even the Obama administration has stuck with the kind of interpretation that was put out under Bush, which is that, you know, unlawful, you know, people who are not members of regular fighting forces have no right to fight. That's a general, you know, principle. But the fact that, you know, killing any American, whether a soldier or a civilian. I mean, the killing of a soldier as a war crime, that's a novelty, and really, it literally was made for Omar. And there was an intense, somewhat clandestine dispute between the Defense Department and the State Department earlier in the year, where the State Department wanted, under the Obama administration, to go back to the pre-Bush interpretations of the Geneva Conventions, and the Department of Defense essentially realized that if they did so, they'd have no grounds to prosecute Omar, and the Defense Department won.
And, Professor, doesn't this impute that there is a higher standard relative to the life of an American killed in combat than anyone else? Because we, in this case, had it gone to trial, one of the critical issues here was essentially a claim by the prosecution that Cotter would be subject to additional punishment and a lengthier sentence because he had, for example, killed this American soldier instead of an Afghan soldier or an Afghan member of, one of their militias or, other fighting groups there.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if that's in the law itself, but certainly that has been a driving issue in the decision going back to 2005 to actually pursue the case against Omar Khadr. It is the fact that they have, a U.S. soldier in this context. I mean, there's nothing in the law that would say that they couldn't have done the same thing to an unlawful enemy combatant, or as it's been re-termed, an unprivileged alien belligerent, to kill an Afghan. But in fact, they've put all their effort to prosecuting Omar because they have a face, and that is the face of Sergeant Speer. And now here in court, they have his widow, who will be giving a victim impact statement during the hearing. Mm-hmm. And in fact, of all the, over 5,000 U.S. soldiers that have died, only Tabitha Speer is seeing some kind of legal vindication, and I would put those in scare quotes, of the death of her husband, where, the thousands of other widows of soldiers who have died in, or widows or widowers of the soldiers who have died in Iraq and Afghanistan, no one is seeing a similar kind of an outcome.
Mm-hmm. So take us through the setup here, because I was surprised once I heard that there was a plea bargain accepted by Cotter and his defense team, that there now is this post-game sentencing process where some of the information that would have been entered into evidence or testimony at a trial is now going to be entered into what you described to me as aggravating and mitigating arguments regarding a downward departure, if we use the American term, of the plea bargain sentence. So in other words, there is no opportunity to increase the sentence beyond the reported 8 years of the plea bargain, but there is an opportunity to reduce it based on a balancing of aggravating and mitigating evidence and testimony.
Yes, this is the way the military commissions are designed to work. And we saw the same thing happening with Ibrahim Okosi, who was an Al-Qaeda cook who agreed to a plea sentence this summer, and his deal is still sealed, but it's reputed to be only 2 years. But what they do, and in the Cotter case, they already had a jury because the trial was underway. The jury is now composed of 7 military officers who were, in fact, ready to come back on October 18th when the trial was scheduled to resume. So that jury was brought in, but with the plea bargain on the first day, on Monday, the jury was brought in. They're called members. I mean, jury is our word, but technically they're members, but I'll call them a jury for familiar purposes. The jury was brought in. The judge announces there has been a plea bargain, and then they read in court what Omar Khadr has pleaded guilty to. I mean, it's called the specification of charges. And on that, which many of us who were down here reporting and observing were surprised, because every single allegation that was ever made against Omar, including ones for which there was very little evidence, are part of what Omar has pled guilty to, which kind of indicates, to just say, yes, I'm guilty. But if, in other words, the only way to get out of Guantanamo is to plead guilty, and then, literally people can get out of Guantanamo by being guilty and sentenced faster than they can by not having been charged at all. So everything that the government had originally charged Omar with is part of this specification, and it's available online. I mean, I've tweeted it on my Twitter thing, and you can find it on other people's. Then now, so the facts of what Omar has pled guilty to, the fact that he now says he threw the grenade that killed Sergeant Spear, the fact that he says that he engaged in attempted murder by building IEDs, improvised explosive devices and planting them, although it's also come out that under interrogation, he told his interrogators exactly where the IEDs were, and they were all found, and none of them ever went off. I mean, he actually conveyed that information. He's also charged with material support, conspiracy, and spying. So those are all facts that are no longer in dispute. Now, what the hearing is really focusing on is why he committed those things and how the jury should understand it. Like, was he, I mean, as the defense will argue, was he pressured by his family or sent, you know, as a boy by his family into, you know, the arms of Al-Qaeda, et cetera? Or, as the prosecution is arguing, did he freely and intentionally join Al-Qaeda and actively work to murder and, you know, attempt to murder Americans? And that's the prosecution's line. So this is, in a sense, what we're getting now is not the facts, but the context. And also, I mean, yesterday and today we had a fascinating, although highly, in my opinion, highly disturbing witness, a government hired psychiatrist named Michael Wellner.
Mm-hmm.
And he essentially, he's famous, his nickname is Dr. Evil, and he's devised this thing called the depravity scale. So he testifies usually recently for the prosecution in many high-profile cases, but his assessment of Omar, based on 7 hours of interviewing him, which is very limited, is that Omar Khadr is an unrepentant and irredeemable murderer and terrorist, and the risk of danger, he poses an enduring risk of future dangerousness. So Wellner was essentially arguing that there's no hope for Omar Khadr. And what was fascinating about the testimony today was that his almost entire knowledge and sort of base, he has no expertise on Islam, and he's arguing that he's an irredeemable radical jihadist, was the work of someone named Nikolai Senels, who's a Danish psychologist. And as it came out, you know, Dr. Wellner has never read Senels' book because it's written in Danish. And when people started looking into Senels between yesterday and today, it was discovered that Senels is a radical Islamophobic eugenicist who's argued that Muslims have been inbreeding. And so the testimony yesterday and today was quite interesting in terms of the credibility of the government's witness about Omar's irredeemability and radical jihadism and so on.
Well, and let me just amplify that, because Dr. Wellner's testimony was reported on in about a 9-column-inch story in my local paper, filed by Ben Fox of the Associated Press, who might be at the desk right next to you.
Yes, Ben Fox is here.
But it reads that, according to Dr. Wellner, Omar Khadr was an extremist when he was taken to Guantanamo, where he was marinated in radical jihadism over 8 years in custody, became a leader among the prisoners. Quote, he's highly dangerous. He's full of rage, Wellner told jurors.
Right.
And he goes on.
Yeah, that's essentially Wellner.
He goes on. There's a further quote of Wellner. He is very angry about being in custody. And he said that he can be quite charming, but he faulted the prisoner for not doing more to improve his limited education, and that he only read Harry Potter books while he was there. This is very interesting, because here we have, and you've given us context for Wellner's history, but we have a so-called expert who is attempting to let the members of the military commission, the jury, as we would call them, get some idea of his state of mind. And while I don't know Omar Khadr, and I can't speak to the extent to which he has been marinated in radical jihadism, I can only suggest that 8 years of, under the circumstances that have been widely reported in this country of the treatment of these individuals who have been held there, would radicalize me even if I hadn't been marinated before I got there.
Well, in fact, the people who know Omar Khadr much better, I mean, his lawyers and two psychiatrists who will be testifying for the defense, are going to argue, in fact, Wellner, who only met Omar for 7 hours, and was, as it came out today, was very selective in the way in which, you know, the information he used. I'm assuming that the defense witnesses are, in fact, going to say, on the contrary, Omar is not, has not become increasingly radicalized in Guantanamo. And, in fact, while, of course, he is angry about being here, he's not sort of irredeemably angry and whether or not he's a, quote, radical jihadist who will never dispense with his passion. But today the defense lawyer really tore Dr. Wellner apart on his, I mean, even on the Harry Potter claim that the only thing Omar Khadr wanted to do was read the Quran, which the doctor used as evidence. The fact that Omar has memorized the Quran for the doctor, that was evidence of his radicalism. The fact that he's popular among prisoners and is often sought out as a leader of prayers, that's another evidence of his irredeemable radicalism. But as it came out today, in fact, he's read Nelson Mandela's book, he's read Barack Obama's book, he's read Danielle Steele. In fact, he's not just some angry Quran memorizing Harry Potter escapist reading type of guy. In fact, he's fairly well read, and what he hasn't been enthralled about reading were textbooks outside of the context of the classroom. And so that was the fact that he didn't want to study anything other than the Quran, according to Wellner, was an evidence of his lack of or refusal to, quote, westernize. I must say, is, really an Islamophobe of a proportion that one doesn't see very often.
Well, and I would just take exception to the Danielle Steele on his reading list. I mean, that's great.
That would be escapism.
Yeah, that's fine for an airplane ride, but nobody should ever brag about that. Well, Lisa, this is very fascinating, and you know, why don't you take another minute or two to share some anecdotes of what you've observed and how our military commissions, which were first suspended and then reinstated by President Obama in a bizarre speech in front of the Constitution at the National Archives. What is the status of these, and as you see them actually play out in this now truncated by plea bargain proceeding, just how much of a joke, legally speaking, are you witnessing?
Well, I mean, I think that the larger issues, you know, sort of prosecuting people on quote-unquote law of war violations for acts that were not, in fact, law of war violations at the time they occurred. I mean, that's a large question that plays out at the level of every single individual case. There's only been a handful of them that have passed through the commission. The difficulty of challenging tortured evidence or even confronting the fact of torture is also, I think, you know, something that's been very much on display in the Omar Khadr case, and you know, I think it will be an issue in other cases down the line as well. But, you know, one of the things that just speaks to what millions that have been spent maintaining this place and keeping the commissions going, after Omar Khadr's case is finished, there's only one other person who's been charged, and his case is Noor Othman, possibly will start next February. There's not even anyone else in line, and there's 174 people still at Guantanamo, several dozen of whom have been cleared for release but haven't been released yet, and you know, some of whom the government is appealing their habeas decisions. But I mean, there's literally nothing that's going to be happening in the military commission for the coming months, and it's unclear what, you know, I mean, there's no vision of any kind of a sense at all. So, I mean, in some ways, you know, the Omar Khadr case is one little slice of a highly crazy and, you know, that nobody's driving this bus, but the bus is costing a huge amount of money, and it's kind of wavering around on the road. Might stall, you know, but we'll still be paying for it for quite a while.
And, Lisa, I understand that you took a tour of the compounds there at Guantanamo over the weekend after you arrived. And I take it they didn't include Camp No, the black site that is outside the main compound where three detainees were killed in June of 2006.
No, I mean, the prison tours, and this is the second one I've taken since coming down to Guantanamo, they're very tightly, you know, sort of limited and orchestrated. I must say that the person who is the deputy detention group commander who gave us the main tour was quite, his name is Andrew Anthony McManus. He was quite forthright, but it was very clear what he could and couldn't tell us. But then we also took a tour within the tour of the prison facility, and so the only things we really saw were Camp 6 and Camp 4, both of which are for, and the hospital. Camp 6 and Camp 4 both hold what are called, quote, compliant detainees who get to live in fairly communal settings. And so in Camp 6, it's actually a prefabricated medium security prison that's been brought down here, so a lot of internal shared space. In Camp 4, which is where Omar Khadr is, and we actually saw Omar. He was out in the yard while we were doing the tour. That's, you know, it's essentially rooms open onto a cement sort of soccer field, and so that's the way Camp 4 is. I did appear that they're interested. It can be found on a website called Jadalia, JADALIYYA.com, or just searching my name and reporting from Guantanamo. That's the name of the photo exhibit.
Yeah, can you spell that again?
JADALIYYA.com. Jadalia.com. And my photo essay is titled Reporting from Guantanamo, the prison tour.
Okay. Well, I will look that up and include
pictures that were taken on Saturday.
I'll include a link in the show file at peterbcollins.com. And, Professor, recently I've been in touch with two men who served well over 7.5 years apiece at Guantanamo. They are some of the individuals who cannot go to their home nations and have been sent to one of 16 nations that have agreed to accept American detainees from Guantanamo. And they don't want too much detail about them to be released at this time because they're very concerned about repercussions. But I can say that one of them was detained at roughly a little bit older than Omar Khadr, and he is still under 30 today. And the other is a man who is a decade or so older. And what's interesting is that each of them were subjected to torture methods, and one of them remains very ill as a result of the treatment that he received at Guantanamo. But I was struck by, in my conversations with them, how they reject bitterness. And in each case, I apologize just on behalf of Americans for what had occurred to them. But given what happened to them and that they both proclaimed their innocence from the beginning, it is amazing how humans can adapt and deal with these very extreme circumstances. And so I'm curious if, and maybe it's too early in the process, but have you seen any positive testimony about Omar that shows that he has been able to absorb all this and yet retain some sense of humanity?
Oh, absolutely. I've seen it myself. I mean, when he was in a court in July, the hearing was when he had, you know, fired his lawyers at that point, and he read a statement in court. It was a very insightful statement, but also we've been hearing, you know, just about his understanding of what's happening. I mean, obviously a frustration with the legal situation, but we also know from his lawyers, particularly the two Canadians, or the one Canadian who's been with Omar through this, he doesn't sort of practice in the military commissions. He serves as the counsel, Dennis Edney. But from everything I've heard from people who've had extended conversations with Omar, he's a very mellow guy. I mean, obviously he's frustrated about his situation, but he has maintained himself under, you know, perhaps incredible conditions considering how young he was when he got here. And ironically, Dr. Wellner's testimony was sort of using his ability to kind of endure and even become a charismatic and popular person within the prison, and to be able to interact with people from the different, prisoners from all different countries. Dr. Wellner tried to use this as an example of how dangerous Omar is. But, I mean, in some ways, everything we've seen of his behavior in court and so on has indicated that, he's really quite well composed. And, he said that if he ever gets out, what he'd really love to do is study to become a doctor, become a contributing member of society someday whenever his sentence may be over. Now, the question of the post-traumatic stress disorder among former prisoners, among prisoners, but also among former prisoners, I think is a problem that hasn't even begun to be studied. I know that the University of California, Davis, has been doing a project, I think it's called the Guantanamo Files, looking at release details, put together a fuller picture of how they've been able to readjust after Guantanamo. So that's an ongoing research project.
Mm-hmm. Well, is there anything you'd like to add before we wrap up?
Well, I think that just the last piece of the story for now will be once the gavel goes down and the jurors go into ruminate on what they've heard, and we'll find out whether or not the sentence they decide to give is higher or lower than the reputed 8 years. Years, because whichever is the lower, that's what Omar will be getting. So we're expecting to be leaving Guantanamo on Monday. So this case will conclude the Guantanamo portion of its hearings by Monday if everything goes according to schedule.
And just one final question that lingers for me. It's a question of fact. What happened to Omar Khadr's father? Because the original story is that he was with his father when they went to Afghanistan from Canada.
No. Oh, he was with his father. I mean, the father was when the whole family was in Pakistan and Waziristan in 2002, and it was the father who sent Omar with an al-Qaeda operative into Afghanistan. The father was killed, and Omar's youngest brother was badly injured by Pakistani forces in a firefight in Pakistan in October of 2003. So the father's dead,
okay,
and now all the rest of the family is back in Canada.
Okay. Very interesting. Well, Lisa, again, I really appreciate your first-person report here, and thank you for playing hooky so that you could cover this, and I really appreciate your interest in the issues.
Thank you. It's really, I'm seeing history being made, even if it's not the best kind of history one would hope for.
Lisa Hajjar, professor of sociology, University of California at Santa Barbara, from Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, today. We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show, sponsored by Cinema Classics, the movie company specializing in classic Hollywood and foreign films. Check out their 30% off sale and their great collection of old movies on DVD and VHS. Just click on the link on the homepage at peterbcollins.com. And to get free shipping on any order, just enter the magic letters PBC in the comments section of the website order form. Speaking of movies, coming up shortly here, Gary Chu reviews the powerful new feature film about Pat Tillman, killed by Americans when he was serving in Afghanistan. And since American forces started serving in Afghanistan over 9 years ago, I have frequently raised the question, are they using the local illicit substances, opium and hashish? Because this became a real problem during the Soviet occupation in the 1980s. And it's often, just so submerged. But the cultivation of opium is the biggest driver in the cash economy in Afghanistan, whose gross domestic product annually is less than $15 billion a year. And it's important to note that the United States is, in one way or another, with military aid and other forms of support, pumping $100 billion a year into Afghanistan right now. And we know that in just the past year, over $8 billion has exited the country probably for Swiss bank accounts. And this past week, it was revealed that Karzai gets satchels full of cash, bags of money, from the Iranians. And when he was called out on this, because a story surfaced of one of his lieutenants hopping on a plane in Tehran with a bag full of euros, Karzai called a news conference and said, yes, it's true. That's how we're running our government. We get cash currency from Iran, and yes, we get bags of money from the United States, too. It's just bizarre. And at the White House, they said, well, we give them money, but I think we transfer it electronically. We don't give them bags of cash. But that's what Karzai maintains. So on the 16th of October, the New York Times filed a lengthy report about a group of soldiers who were out in the boonies of Afghanistan. And one of them, who's aptly named Private First Class Justin Stoner, reported to his superiors that members of his platoon would blatantly smoke marijuana before they deployed to Afghanistan. And when they got there, says the drug use continued among as many as 20 of the 30 platoon members at forward base Ramrod, where the group and its leaders lived close to each other in small prefab housing units. They say that they used the unit that Private Stoner shared with a roommate for drinking alcohol, which they got in the mail, and for smoking hash that they could easily get from Afghan interpreters. And Private Stoner said that this past May, the hash smoking in his room was to the point where the smoke was lingering in the air and the smell was impossible to get rid of. In one interview, Private Stoner was described by specialist Winfield's lawyer Eric Montalvo as the platoon's effective drug dealer. But Stoner, I can't get over his name. Stoner told investigators he has never used illicit substances himself, a claim that investigators discarded. So we've got a Stoner who's turning in his buddies for getting stoned. And, you know, basically, it's so easy to get. And the Afghan interpreters and some of the Afghan police and militia who they are in contact with smoke hash and apparently opium all the time. And so the officers in this area say, well, you know, we thought it was just the Afghans who were creating this strong aroma on our forward base. And so I want to take a couple of moments here and play you a song from one of my favorite bands from the 1980s, a British group that kind of morphed from being a hardcore punk act into a kind of power pop with a message band. And they were always held back by their name, the Stranglers. As you can imagine, it has a certain cachet for marketing, but doesn't really seem MTV friendly. And the Stranglers put out a series of B-side recordings that were essentially created for their own amusement. And they were a series of story songs about a mythical guy named Vladimir, who was a Soviet soldier serving in Afghanistan. And I believe there are four, maybe at the most six, different songs about Vladimir. In my collection, I have Vladimir and the Beast and Vladimir Goes to Havana. And I'd like you to hear this because it is satirical, but it's based on fact that many of the soldiers who were sent to occupy Afghanistan and who suffered great loss of life during the Soviet occupation were numbing themselves with the local locally available, locally produced drugs. And if you go ahead and turn this one up and listen carefully, because the way they mix it together, it's kind of hard to hear the narrator at times. But you get the message here. The Stranglers, Vladimir and the Beast.
Greatest socialist democracy could one hope to be forgiven for losing temporary sight of the aims and goals of the Marxist-Leninist revolution. 2 years it took me to be cured of my illness. Being still a relatively young and fit man, I was still in search of fulfillment. The memory of Olga, Sergei, and my two children motivated me to seek an occupation that would both repay my debt to my great party and obviously help the way to international socialism. I was still unable to resume my lectureship in subnucleonic particle physics and therefore volunteered to help our Afghan comrades in their great struggle for liberation. I was readily accepted into a motorized maintenance unit. Support for the liberation struggle of our comrades in Afghanistan was not viewed altogether unanimously by the local population. In fact, we were not allowed outside of the barracks unless we were in large armored groups. During our brief stay in Afghanistan, we had discovered some of the very few pleasures open to visitors to this desolate place. A local concoction called hashish was being increasingly used by our troops, and many of the helicopter gunship and tank crews, moreover, would smoke large chillums and joints before embarking on missions around the mountains surrounding Kabul. Every week, comrades who had fallen into the hands of the rebels would be found in envenomed around the camp. Those unlucky enough to be still alive were sent for rehabilitation to the German Democratic Republic, since this would prevent any undue alarm by our loved ones back home. The wisdom of this policy is evidence of our leaders' great care for their people. Apart from hashish, there was not much to divert one during the cold mountain nights, and increasingly there were signs of the troops acquiring the illness of which I had previously been cured. And therefore, my attention was focused more on looking after the few animals that were kept within the military compound. As is often the case between human beings and animals, a close bond of affection can develop. And I became increasingly close to a camel I named Dimitri. Ah, dear Dimitri. No one can really understand the relationship between a man and his camel, as was the case with the army doctors and my superiors who sent me to convalesce in the German Democratic Republic.
That's for Private First Class Justin Stoner. And I hope you don't develop a close bond with a camel while you're in Afghanistan, because I don't think you have an option to go to the German Democratic Republic, either for drug rehab or for treatment of infatuation with a dromedary, right? I think that's right. So I just think this is the tip of the iceberg. I have to imagine that many American troops are using hash and opium in Afghanistan, and it's finally starting to break out into the open. On to some correspondence. I receive emails and dispatches from many different people with many different viewpoints. And I have an email account at peterbcollins.com where all this stuff goes, and I cull through it. And there's one that I've been fascinated by, and I have no idea how I got on his email list. He is a Zionist from Jerusalem named, and if you'd like to see what he does or get these, it's almost daily, email blasts, you can go to israpundit.com. That's what he calls his website, ISRA Pundit, P-U-N-D-I-T, israpundit.com. So Ted is pretty reliable at reporting the hardline Zionist point of view in Israel. And even the Netanyahu government incurs his wrath, despite their hardliner approach. And recently, I decided to see if I could engage Ted Bellman in a little dialogue. Because I was offended by a series of his reports that not only gave scorecards about how members of the U.S. House and Senate have voted on issues related to Israel, but it then took those scorecards and applied, I think, very vicious, hateful labels to certain members of House and House and Senate here in the United States. And so he published first a scorecard about members of the House, where Congresswoman Lois Capps was a fairly moderate member of Congress who represents Santa Barbara and Ventura, north of Los Angeles, along the California coast. And it first described her, because of her votes, as quote-unquote virulently anti-Israel. Now, I don't think that's a fair characterization, but I read it, and it bothered me. The next day, there was another scorecard, mostly on the same issues, but the layout was a little different. And it referred to Lois Capps and others as anti-Semitic. And this, to me, is quite hateful. And it shows the extremism of a point of view that says if you oppose policies of the state of Israel, that you are anti-Semitic, that you hate Jews and you want them dead. That's what that term means. This campaign sees a lot of Hitler references and some Holocaust references, usually misplaced. But when a person who is Jewish and who calls themselves a Zionist, either by carelessness or by intent, moves from labeling someone anti-Israel to anti-Semitic, well, I've got a problem. So I wrote Ted Bellman a very conciliatory email. And I pointed out that I would never presume to tell Israelis how to score their members of the Knesset and who deserves re-election or who deserves to be drummed out of office. I just wouldn't do that. I wouldn't interfere in Israeli politics in that manner. I wouldn't presume to know enough about the issues of these people to simply look at their voting record and say that so-and-so in your Knesset is virulently anti-American, and there is no equivalent, really, of anti-Semitic to nationalist terms, all right? Because it has to do with race and religion, ethnicity. And so there's no real way to compare that to language that we would use in the United States. But I pointed out to Ted that this is not only a problematic interference by an Israeli in American politics, that it was not in Israel's best interest to demand 100% loyalty from every member of the American Congress. And to enforce that loyalty through name-calling of the most vicious, lowest order to achieve such an objective. Well, my internet service is down, and so I can't pull up my original email to Ted to explain to you exactly what I said and why it was so reasonable. But one of the things that I pointed out was that his scorecard was dinging members of the House and the Senate for attending a dinner at J Street. And J Street is this moderate that tries to counter the extremism of AIPAC. And I've interviewed their executive director, I can't summon his name right now. But they are hardly anti-Israel, and they are certainly not anti-Semitic. After all, they're Jewish. And I know there is a concept of the self-hating Jew, but I don't buy it, and I'm not going to waste time on that today. So, in one of his responses to me, Ted Bellman wrote, J Street is anti-Israel. Much has been written on the subject. J Street tries to define what is pro-Israel. I don't buy it one bit. Any supporter of J Street is also anti-Israel, assuming they are informed. Anyone who thinks J Street is pro-Israel is anti-Israel in my book. Now, J Street's posture is to try to find a middle ground and to move forward with a peace process that could allow Jews and non-Jews to live without violence and hatred in this very small territory that they both have claims to. Ted Bellman goes on, thinking people, that's in quotes, who support J Street worship at the altar of liberalism. And he misspells altar. They have an agenda as much as I have an agenda. We are all thinking people. I reject their agenda. He goes on. The left generally is anti-American and anti-Israel. Now you can see that this is a person who does not believe in compromise of any sort. He goes on. I support Zionism. I believe that the territories are our lands, not Palestinian land. I have facts and history to back it up. I want to fight for what's ours. You probably think of the lands as Palestinian lands. You fight for their rights, not Jewish rights. I am unwilling to change my position to get their support. They support Obama also. He is our enemy. Thus, they are our enemy or our misguided. They want Obama to force a deal on Israel. I want Obama to butt out. Now, this is the guy who's interfering in American elections, and he wants Obama to butt out. Then the clincher. I want the peace process to end because it is designed to force Israel to give up its rights. And his closer? I am not in the slightest extreme. It is the J Street supporters that are extreme. And then he started another sentence with I and ran out of gas. And I find this sad because I attempted to reason with this man who I've never met, never talked to. And he went on a tirade and exposes himself as an extremist, even as he says he is not slightest in the slightest extreme, and J Street supporters, who everyone knows are moderates, he says, are extreme. Don't have much to work with there, do we? And Obama is his enemy. Obama has been so... I give him credit for his speech in Cairo, for appointing George Mitchell as a special envoy, for starting early in his administration to try to build a new peace process between Israel and Palestine. but he's not exercising any leadership on it. He's not investing any real political capital, and he doesn't expect any real change. He's been so timid in challenging Israel's insistence on continuing their illegal settlements in the West Bank and near Jerusalem, which Ted Bellman says are flatly the property of Israel, and I think he's depending on the Torah as the basis for that. And finally, a clipping that's getting a little yellow here was published October 8 in the New York Times, an op-ed under the signature of William D. Cohan, C-O-H-A-N. He's a columnist for thenewyorktimes.com and the author of House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, and he has a new book coming out about Goldman Sachs. And in it, he made a very important point that the much-touted Obama Wall Street reform isn't going to do much. The banksters will just maneuver right around it, and where there are benefits to consumers, they'll screw consumers by charging more fees. And while Elizabeth Warren has been given the job of setting up the new consumer protection agency spawned by this, I'm not very optimistic that we've addressed the serious problems of the excessive leverage, the overall risk-taking, and the combination of toxic assets that were insured, and the way people could make money by betting on toxic assets. And so Cohan writes, bankers and traders still have the same irresponsible, accountability-free incentives that they've had for the past 40 years to generate as much revenue as they possibly can, regardless of the consequences. And he goes on to argue that we should make bankers put their own money on the line. He goes on, we already have definitive proof that Wall Street's compensation practices lead to excessive risk-taking. Witness the way Wall Street's armies kept selling mortgage-backed securities filled with defaulting home mortgages long after the securities made any sense as an investment. And so what he argues is that the people who work on Wall Street should have to cough up their bonuses when they screw us. He says, let me find it here. The days of privatizing the profits for Wall Street and socializing the risks must end. I propose that each large Wall Street firm create a new security that represents and is secured by the entire net worth of its top 100 executives. This security would be subordinated to all other creditors. In other words, if a firm goes bankrupt, this would be the first to be wiped out. He said, had such a security existed at the time of the collapse of Lehman Brothers, the net worth of the top 100 executives, no doubt totaling several billion dollars, would have been collected after liquidating everything they owned and paid to Lehman creditors, who under the current system will be lucky if they get a dime for a dollar. And I think this is brilliant. If these guys, and it is mostly guys, but a few gals, if these people want to take risk, huge amounts of money, then they've got to put their own net worth on the line. And he closes by saying, pretty harsh, right? Well, maybe, but Wall Street deserves no sympathy. Had this security or something like it been in place at every Wall Street firm 5 years ago, there'd have been no mortgage bubble, no financial crisis, no deep and unsettling economic recession with nearly 10% employment, no need for the TARP, and no need for Dodd-Frank. That's the formal name of the Wall Street so-called reform legislation that was passed this year in 2010. I'll be looking for William Cohan's new book about Goldman Sachs and see if I can track him down for an interview. Next, Gary Chu reviews the film about Pat Tillman, an Only in America story.
Only in America can a guy from anywhere go to sleep a pauper and wake up a millionaire. Only in America.
The most profound ad-lib in Jewish director Amir Bar-Lev's film, The Tillman Story, comes from a seasoned military special ops guy. He says something to the effect, "The movie could be an opportunity for reality to break through." The story of football great and Army Ranger Pat Tillman still weighs heavily on the U.S. It seems like a perfectly made-up story out of Hollywood, but really happened. And the final part of it has as sorry an ending as any ever created in La La Land. To review, the Arizona State star athlete put his lucrative NFL career on hold and unceremoniously enlisted in the U.S. Army. He fought and died in Afghanistan, struck down by friendly fire from part of his own platoon that was separated from the rest and out of radio contact due to the rugged terrain. Although that's not how the military had it up front. It was a Jessica lynching, so to speak. In death, Pat was cast as heroic, laying down his life for comrades in a Taliban ambush. The government posthumously awarded him the Silver Star, and praises to his unflinching valor were publicly sung by George W. Bush on down. We now know the Tillman family was punked by U.S. authorities. Pat's brother Kevin, also in Pat's unit, was ordered to keep a shut mouth about how his brother really died. Kevin and another GI close to Pat in the unit were quickly whisked back to the States in a military cargo plane. The story of the whole snafu is pretty much common knowledge today about how resilient the Tillman family was and continues to be, including Pat's wife, Marie. Pat's mom and dad and siblings proved not the sort to go gentle into that good night when official lies are told. Despite the rough language the Tillman males use in the picture, they appear to have a strong respect for truth, which is especially underscored by Tillman's mother, Mary, who the film suggests is where the family's attitude takes much of its strength. The Tillman story shines as a meticulously detailed but still engrossing, if not enraging, film. One of the most moving clips shows Rich Tillman eulogizing his brother ad-lib at a memorial service. With the knife, you can cut the pathos and anger shown by the younger Tillman. Not a minced word spoken. Television News chose not to carry Rich's eulogy, even with bleeping some of his words of rage. Mark Monroe's script makes clear that Pat Tillman was an extraordinary person, with a sense of integrity and honor that measure beyond what the distortions about his demise suggest as heroism. But one of Pat's traits wasn't related as news of his death spun through the news cycles. Tillman was an atheist. The other soldier who was spirited away from the battlefield with Pat's brother was almost as close to Pat as Kevin. His name is Brian O'Neill. He was with Pat when the friendly fire began. The film has several moving moments as O'Neill speaks of the respect he holds for Tillman. One of the qualities that most impressed him about Tillman was how accepting Pat was of Specialist O'Neill, a Mormon. O'Neill had once found Pat in quarters reading the Book of Mormon. Tillman, by the way, was the devotee of the leader of America's Transcendentalist movement of the mid-19th century, Ralph Waldo Emerson of Massachusetts. Brian testified at a subsequent congressional hearing that, trying to tell the friendlies to cease fire, his buddy's last words were, "Hey, I'm Pat fucking Tillman." Many up and down the chain of command chose not to relate just how Tillman was killed. O'Neill, when ordered back to the platoon following his being taken from the scene, refused to go back to that unit. Bonding among soldiers in battle seems as cementing a relationship as any in the story about Pat Tillman, even when one is a believer and one isn't. I found this, among many, to be the documentary's most powerful message. To close, a personal anecdote not related to the tragic death of a star football player and U.S. Army Ranger, but the quiet, anonymous, and welcome birth of my son. I was on Army Reserve duty in Louisiana in 1966 when he was born. The Army gave me time to return to Tulsa to be with my wife and son. I drove my car from Fort Polk to the Shreveport, Louisiana airport, about 100 miles, and caught a Brana flight on to Tulsa so I could be there as soon as possible. While in Tulsa, one of the local newspapers ran an item about my sudden trip back to the city. The story had it that the military, to expedite the trip to see my new son, had flown me from Fort Polk to Shreveport in a chopper. On duty at Fort Polk, I worked at my unit's public information office. On returning from Tulsa to Polk, I didn't say anything to anyone there about the item I'd read in the newspaper reporting my helicopter ride. I've always thought, though, flying in one might be a lot of fun. The good twist in all of this unfortunate recent history of Corporal Pat Tillman is that he turned out to be an even larger hero than the military purported him to be, Silver Star and all. The guy with his voice has many more film reviews for you to read to yourself at TulsaTVMemories.com and under reviews by title at IMDb.com. I'm Gary Chu, over and down in the valley, just northeast of Eden.
Thanks for listening to the Peter B. Collins Show. Hey, when do you think we'll ever close Guantanamo?
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.